Good morning. It is Thursday, April 12th, study session, and we have three presentations. We are going to excuse Mayor Smith this morning. He is out of town on some very important business. And we will begin this morning to hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the arts and cultural budget issues. Good morning.
Be here talking about not only the coming year, but really how it flows out of what we've been building this year and the last few years. I'd like to begin by talking about the innovations in our department, in the Arts and Culture Department, and of course that includes all three institutions, the Mesa Arts Center, the Arizona Museum for Youth, and the Arizona Museum of Natural History. The first area of innovation that you've heard me talk about before is that we continue to work on growth with numerous initiatives for active engagement of the community. And with each of these slides, I'm probably just going to pick out one or two examples, something I think you might not be as familiar with, and then if you have questions, of course, I'll be happy to answer them. In the area of active engagement, I just wanted to mention that you might not be aware that we're doing this wonderful creative aging program that we piloted this year, which included doing workshops at residential senior facilities, daycare senior facilities, and including a special program with Serine Adult Daycare working with patients with dementia. And that was a wonderful and successful program that we're continuing next year. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Another area of innovation is the continued growth of our school programs and partnerships. We've really, really worked on increasing the number, the scope, and the depth of those education programs. And, you know, one of the things we're really proud of are the expansion of our residencies in the schools and community. And I wanted to, the one I wanted to highlight on this page is that this year we had a two-week residency with an L.A. dance company called Contratiempo Urban Latin Dance Theater. And they spent, they did about 16 workshops in the schools and community. And the most exciting thing for us was that they ended up featuring 22 elementary school students from Mesa Public Schools in their public performance at the Acada. And their the families were all invited for those students. That was really an exciting program. That's the kind of thing we want to continue to grow as we move into the new year. We've also been really working hard on what you might call external relations, things that involve growing our audience, growing our membership and donor base, and we have some new initiatives for the coming year. One thing that we'll be continuing that we have done, as you can see, is consistent branding across our different programs. This one shows the branding for Performing Live, and you can see that we're trying to really get greater impact by continued use of certain kinds of a look and brand identity elements. And also this coming year, something we're doing that's new is we're going to be doing a lot of additional research and strategic planning around development and donor cultivation, and we're really excited about increasing those efforts. We are adding at the Mesa Arts Center one new FTE for the coming year. This is a theater technician position. As you know, we've been just going gangbusters in our theaters with our performing live shows and our rentals. And frankly, we really need this to expand a couple of key earned revenue areas where we need that support so we can basically service the clientele and service the ticket sales through the work that we do in the theaters. So that new FTE is designed to help us do that. At the Arizona Museum of Natural History, we've made really big strides with a new social media initiative. They have a very small marketing budget, and they think they're using dollars very, very wisely in reaching out through social media to really engage their various constituent groups and potential audiences, and it's showing great success, really big return on a relatively small investment with a temporary staff person with an expertise in this area. We're very proud of that. And then you've already heard before about the wonderful growth of the and growth in quality of the internally generated exhibitions and the way the volunteers have been integrated into that effort. We're very proud of that at the Museum of Natural History. In addition, of course, the big news at Natural History is that there's going to be a grand opening this coming year, finally, of a very exciting project, the Mesa Grande Cultural Park. And the bidding construction bid is out, and we're going to be making that into a publicly available resource throughout the season that it's open, which excludes the hot months when obviously there wouldn't be a lot of people wanting to spend 3 hours out spending all that time out in a 3-acre site in the middle of the summer. But we're very, very excited about that and looking forward to an opening toward the end of this year. At the Arizona Museum for Youth, couple of things I really want to share with that are happening. There's a lot of great work being done there. One of the really interesting innovations is they're currently working on developing a new program that would eventually be a new earned revenue stream, and that's an exhibition rental business. Sonny O'Rourke was awarded a Piper Fellowship, and that was specifically to go around the country researching the opportunities for building an exhibition rental business, what the needs were in the field for new material that people wanted to use in their museums. It's sort of a win-win. We can develop things that our community gets to benefit from first when we premiere it, but then we can also get additional revenue by having it toured to other institutions. So we're very excited about that. It's in the developmental stage, but we hope to do a couple of pilots this coming year with that. Another big one for AMI is the Image for the Future campaign. They are working currently on, we just have gotten the results of market research they did to understand better where AMI's identity fits into the museum field, the children's museum field, and the cultural field as a whole, both in Arizona and nationally. And they're now going to begin work on defining how to respond to that with a new identity, probably some new programmatic initiatives and potentially a new name. That, of course, would all be vetted in front of you when it's developed. And really a new brand, because there's a lot of concern over Arizona Museum for Youth not really explaining to someone what the experience will be when they arrive at the institution. And we want something that's going to be more galvanizing, more exciting, and really drive new audiences who are excited about what they're going to experience when they get there. We want the name and the brand to support that. And so that's what that effort is really all about. What you have in front of you now is the expense budget for next year, as it was, as you've been seeing it from other departments, broken out in two ways, by category and by funding source. And really there's just a couple of things I want to point out on here, and then I'd be happy to take any questions. One is that we do have some adjustment requests before management that are not reflected here at this point. They're not in these figures. So the proposed number would be slightly higher with those adjustment requests in them. The year-to-date is only through February. We did not have the March figures at the time we prepared this, so that those are only through February. But we are feeling very good about where we are this fiscal year, and we're expecting to end the year under budget on expenses and quite a bit over on revenue. The only individual item I wanted to point out, because it will jump out at you, is that you'll see in the 11-12 year-end estimate under other services, there's a big negative variance against budget there, and of about $500,000. And that is made up of a number of different things that are above and beyond what was originally budgeted. The component parts are, we had, of course, the CNN event, which was unexpected and added to the budget. Then there were two contingency budgets that were approved, one for the Creativity Festival and one for the building of the large, you'll remember, the large pterosaurs, the flying reptiles. And then there were some additional costs that were the result of expenses that were due to what was needed in order to produce additional revenues. In other words, to provide services to rentals that came in that produced revenue, or to additional other programs where they produced revenue there were expenses related to that, but they were directly covered and then some by the revenues they produced. So that's that number is the one that jumps out, and I wanted to give that explanation. But I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions on that? Dennis?
I appreciate the presentation. What you're forecasting for next year, again, does show a lot of innovative research being put into action and continuing to grow audiences. One of the questions I have is, how is the landscape for on the private donation, the private contribution side, both to the Mesa Arts Center and the two museums? I know this has been a very difficult time for nonprofits across the world, across the whole scene, whether it's arts or anything else. And I'm curious as to how our support groups have been faring and what you forecast for the coming year.
Well, we are, I would use the word cautiously optimistic. On the corporate side, it's been tough across the valley, but we actually have fared better in that area than many of our colleagues. We've done fairly well with holding steady. We have lost a couple of corporate donors where they switched their area of focus, and we were no longer, you know, our programming didn't fall into the areas they were currently funding. But we have actually grown the funding from a couple of our large corporate sponsors, and we feel really proud of that in this economy. In the individual side, we're a little bit soft, but there are a couple of good signs and key initiatives to try to address that. One is that our retention rate, especially for our members over 500 or more, is very high, 90-something percent, and that's a really good sign because those are that's the bread and butter of the donor program and the people that you ultimately would ask for major gifts. So we have excellent retention of our high-level members. The other area of it is that, as I was actually discussing with the foundation board at their last meeting, we're like toddlers. We're not infants anymore, but we're only 7 years old as a new institution, if you think of the new Mesa Arts Center as really being a new phase of life. And so at the Mesa Arts Center specifically, I think that we've been growing our user base to such a great extent that we now are sort of on the cusp of a next stage and level of development work, because now we have this huge database to begin mining with research to understand who the primary prospects might be. And so we're going to be part of our adjustment request in front of management is a research project where we will mine the data in our user base to do a very targeted pilot cultivation project with the most likely donors. And so we're actually feeling pretty optimistic about given all the positive recognition, the awards we've been getting. We recently were named Best Art Center in the Valley. We feel, and you know, with the attention from the debate, we feel we're very well poised to take advantage of all that. So on individual income, I'm optimistic.
You know, one of the interesting several weeks ago, we were at the Governor's Annual Arts Awards, and the corporation that won the Business of the Year award was J.P. Morgan Chase, who I think the city does its banking with, and I find it ironic that J.P. Morgan Chase has contributed nothing that I can understand to the Mesa Arts Center, the Arizona Museum for Youth, or the Museum of Natural History. I guess it's kind of disappointing that someone the city has done business with for so many years that contributes to the arts elsewhere in the valley seemingly ignores a big customer. So I'm hoping maybe that's an opportunity.
That is on our target list to really work hard to see if we can't make inroads this year. They actually have been very inactive in the East Valley and much more active in the center of the valley. So we're actually going to make a big push on that this year. The other thing I wanted to mention was the two museums, and they are also both Arizona Museum of Natural History has no staff for development, and that is something we really want to work on. So their main contributed area is, although they have some, the main one is in grants. At Arizona Museum for Youth, they've been doing a very, very aggressive effort to increase their contributed income stream, and they've had some excellent success this spring with a challenge grant from Don Whiteman, so that and the Whiteman family. So that was a great initiative, and we really do feel the new branding will be a platform for new individual prospecting at Amy.
And one final comment. I'm very pleased that the Mesa Grande Cultural Park will be opening. It's kind of ironic. It was 22 years ago this month, the Museum and Cultural Advisory Board for the city, of which I chaired at that point, approved both 5- and 10-year plans for capital projects in the art center scene. And on the 10-year plan, by 2000, we were supposed to have the cultural park open. But 22 years later, it's going to happen. But I appreciate the support we've received from the granting entities and the communities, as well as your staff, to make it happen, because it's a very important cultural asset for the community. And though long delayed, it's going to be, I think, welcome and really add again to the cultural offerings that we have in the East Valley and our community. So I congratulate you on that.
Thank you. We're very excited about it. I should mention one other thing with natural history, which is that they are celebrating an anniversary. I think Tom's here, isn't it?
35th.
A 35th anniversary. And so they're planning next month a big birthday party. So keep your ears open about that. We'll be looking forward to celebrating that in May with the Museum of Natural History. Great. No other questions? And of course, behind there for your perusal at your leisure are information about our performance metrics and also some of our points of pride for this past year. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Anything else from the? Okay, great. So we shall move on to the library budget. You're expecting a longer introduction. That's it. Library, next.
They bring it up first.
I'll do introductions while Bob gets the machine running here.
Where is it?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Vice Mayor Summers. I'm Heather Wolf, the library director. This is Don Kusrak, the library's management assistant.
And is your mic on? Or is it just the library voice?
Can you hear me now?
It's a library voice.
It's a library voice.
Okay. It's a library voice. I'll try to project a little bit more. As you know, for fiscal year 12-13, our city manager has challenged all of the departments to really look at innovations and best practices and beyond. Our first slide here is our mission. I'm not going to read it to you. I just want you to know that the staff use that as our guide in deciding what innovations to move forward with. We really wanted to focus on how to increase access to our library resources. And I'm very excited. We have six innovations to share with you, just brief highlights, but I think you'll see that they're pretty innovative, and our staff worked very hard on these. Our first innovation is to expand hours. We've been working on this a long time, basically since January 2009 when we reduced hours. Staff have used the last several years to really examine how we do things on a daily basis. We've looked at what steps we do, what positions do what work, and we've really tried to use technology to help us do our job faster, more efficiently, so that we can spend more time with our customers. In December, the council approved three new, and I'll try to use the proper term, intelligent return and sorting systems. We just call them the bin sorters. There's a picture of the Red Mountain one there on the slide for you. The last one was installed at Main Library on Tuesday and is fully operational. I know that Councilmember Kavanaugh has used the one at Dobson, so they're pretty amazing innovations for us, and they are going to help us move about 2.5 FTEs from behind the scenes to direct customer service. So it's a huge innovation for us, and that's one of the many steps that's going to allow us to expand hours. I also want to compliment Cindy's department, as well as Parks and Rec and Development and Sustainability. Programming is a big part of libraries. We've reduced staff. It's harder for us to do that, but we've been able to partner with three other city departments to offer programs to our patrons, and it's been a huge success for us, and we really appreciate their help in helping us meet the needs of our customers. So I want to compliment them for that. The next slide is our current schedule and our new schedule. And really, I just want to point out two things about the new schedule. First of all, it means that all four locations will have the exact same hours. It's been quite a few years since that has happened. We're very excited that you don't have to live near the main library to get the most hours of library service. Second, it's a 30% increase with no increase in our staffing costs. We have actually increased FTEs, but we've taken some higher level, more highly paid positions and turned them into more flexible, lower paid positions that allow us to work with the customer. Our next innovation comes from our branch manager at Red Mountain, Kelly Gillespie. She saw something in the literature. It's not really something that's being done here in the United States, but self-service hours are being done in Canada and New Zealand. And we asked ourselves, is this something we could do? Before we open at 10, library staff are in the building, the lights are on, and we're doing a lot of housekeeping. You know, we're putting books back, we're pulling books to fill holds. We're up there on the public floor. So we asked ourselves, while we don't have enough staff to staff a desk and answer phones, is there a way to let a customer into the building and they can provide their own service? And we've started looking at all the things that a customer can do on their own without a body at the desk. And we found out there was a lot of things they could do. So from 9 to 10 every morning, we won't advertise the hours as full service. We're just going to open the doors, we'll have a sandwich board, and then we'll have a sign at the desk letting people know there's no one at the desk from 9 to 10. But they can come into the library from 9 to 10. And I'm not sure how many of you go past the main library, but about 9:30, there is a crowd of people waiting for the library to open. So we're really excited that these people will at least be able to come in, use the computers, check out their books, and those sorts of activities. Yes.
Thank you. Is that just at the main library or at the branches,
no,
too?
No, all locations. And actually, we found out that the Express Library was sort of already doing this. Because they're in the retail center and they have just a little gate, it was very obvious when people were just sort of standing there. So they were just opening up the gate and letting people conduct business. So it was already being done just unofficially. We're going to pilot it for 6 months. We want to make sure that the customer has a positive experience. Staff are a little concerned that, you know, they'll be disappointed if they can't get a library card or pay a fine. But I think there's so many other things that they can do, they'll just be excited that they can come into the library an hour earlier.
Great, thank you.
Our next innovation, first let me explain the name. Establish iMesa Links. iMesa Links, the iMesa, of course, is a reference to the mayor's iMesa program. And Links is an acronym, and it's referencing what we want to happen in the space. We want people to be able to learn, we want them to innovate, network, connect, and succeed. This is a very new concept. Libraries are doing pieces of this. As far as we can find so far, there isn't a library doing all of these things. Right now, the traditional model for libraries is we collect information and ideas. And people come in and access that information, those ideas, and then they go home and they create content at home. We want our library to be a place where people can be creative within the library. And we want to give them access to the technology, the software, the equipment to do that. So we're going to take it up another level. iMesa Links would give the community access to a collaborative workspace, to the equipment that you might find in a digital media lab, as well as equipment you might find in a hacker space. So a number of different ideas. And then really our target is the people who don't have access to these things at home or at school or at work, or they need access outside of those areas. So We're still in the planning stages of this, but we're very excited. We're working with Mesa Council College. We plan to engage local small businesses, the chamber, community-based organizations, as well as Mesa Public Schools, and we're going to be looking to them to not only help us program the space, what does your constituency need in this space, but we're also looking at them to help us reach that target and that target audience. And we're also hoping that they will be community instructors in this space, that they'll be willing to help people who come to this space use this equipment and accomplish those goals.
Mayor, Vice Mayor and Council, actually, this idea came with a collaboration with the Chamber and Mesa Public Schools and Heather. So we all came together, and then it was actually an idea that the three of us came up with, the organizations, and then it was put on the iMesa list. And we were kind of trying to figure out how to go through the implementation, and so we've decided to start off in a library and really see if this collaboration with Mesa Public Schools, where they can bring their technology and their software into the libraries, that it can be a resource for small businesses through the chamber. Chamber can actually maybe have where they bring in their members to do seminars or small business assistance with technology. Mesa Public Schools, if we can have access to their technology and their software, that their students who may not have access to the technology at home can still do their projects and homework with the same software equipment that they experience in the classroom. Now they can come to a library and experience that. And so we've been talking to them about maybe sharing with either equipment or licensing cost. And then we've got, obviously, from the community, there's a whole lot of opportunities. I mean, we already have a tremendous amount of use of computers today
right.
in the library. So we want to have a dedicated space and kind of create this, I don't know, the laboratory, hacker space, as Heather likes to call it. And we've gone down to, I just lost the name.
Gangplank
to see how they've done this kind of creative space where people can kind of come and go and work on projects. So we're going to try that in some space at Red Mountain, Red Mountain, see how it works, and then you know come back, report, and see if that's something that appeals to the community.
What kind of software would they have access to?
So we're still working on that. It could be a variety of different applications.
Yeah, it depends on, like for the business people, it's a PC environment, and we're going to need a Microsoft-type stuff. But for the digital media lab, where people are recording music and video, it's going to be an Apple world. And so we met with ITD, and they're going to have some fun, I think Diane's group, and really
have fun,
and really take my basic list and really kind of talk about. Diane had a really good point. She said, "You need scenarios. What would somebody come into this space to do?" So, like I said, you know, a school-age student might come into this space. They need to record a presentation for class, and maybe they want to do a video presentation. You know, the small business person comes in, and they need help on how to use the social media network to market their business. So what do they need? And that's kind of where we're coming at, is developing these scenarios, and then ITD can then figure out what equipment is necessary to accomplish that goal.
And it really helps us bridge the gap, too, of the community between parts of our community that don't have technology in their homes, and yet the world that we're going into in education requires that they have at least some experience and exposure to the technology. So, you know, we're trying to provide that in a public setting where more of our children, school-age population, can have access to that. Now, we know putting in a library is a space we can control to do it. Ultimately, if the model works, we'd like to figure out ways to, you know, get it further out closer to the community so they can enjoy it.
Okay.
In our next slide, staff are excited about this, and I'll try to explain it in a way that makes sense to non-library people, but the Collection HQ software is really an amazing tool for us. Our materials budget, the money we use to buy items that we check out, has been reduced greatly over the years. And that puts even greater pressure on the staff to make the selections of what is most needed by our customer and what format is most needed. Because one title can be available in 7 different formats. How many copies of each of those formats do we buy? This software allows us to do analysis on our collection using information from our catalog that we can't do now. Plus, it allows us to compare ourselves to libraries across the nation. So we're going to be able to do best practices and find out, you know, we've weeded the photography collection. All of our books were out of date. There's 100 titles. Well, these are the top 10 performers across libraries in the United States. So let's buy these 10 titles out of the 100. So those sorts of decisions, basically evidence-based decisions. Right now, we make highly educated guesses, and we guess right most of the time. But this will help us make sure that we're using that money very effectively and making sure that we meet what our citizens want on the shelves. And then our next one is we want to update Dobson. The Red Mountain Library was remodeled in 2003. Maine was remodeled in 1998. Dobson will be 25 years old in June, and all that's been done to Dobson is we got new carpet and we've brought it up to ADA standards. So we need to make it a 21st library. If you've been there, it's a beautiful facility. It's well-loved by the community that uses it, but we need to refresh it, and we need to make technology work inside that building. Right now, we can't add any more computers because of the way it's laid out. So we would really like to make it, shine it up and refresh it and make it lively again. So that's our goal there.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a generic question on Dobson. Do we draw from outside the city there, so
yes,
it's a net positive for us?
Yes. Vice Mayor Summers, Councilwoman Higgins, there is a large Chandler segment of the population that does use the Dobson Library. So, yes, we do draw from outside of the Dobson area.
And with the new way of doing our library cards, that ends up helping us. Is that
yes,
right?
It does end up helping us.
Thank
you. And this is our last innovation. We're looking at ways to investigate self-service to commuters. And we're specifically looking at the Superstition Springs Mall Transit Center.
Good. I mean, that's the natural thing.
Well,
that's where I would put it.
Well, I have
good
to.
Good luck with the rest of this.
I have to acknowledge Mike James. Last night, he emailed me at 11:30 at night what the ridership for Superstition Springs is, and approximately 65,000 trips happen per month there. So it would be a fantastic place to provide self-service. Now, the pictures, obviously, there is a gamut of ways to provide self-service. There is low-tech, low-cost, and high-tech, high-cost. So we're somewhere in the middle there just investigating.
Have we thought about putting one over at the end of the light rail line?
Well,
Sycamore?
Actually, Vice Mayor and Council, that's where we were actually talking about was the thought of incorporating it in with light rail. And that could be another option. But as we were thinking about, you know, this is a good idea, we really wanted to pilot program it quickly, we thought, well, maybe we ought to start somewhere where we can have some close proximity with the libraries, we can get to an area that we can probably manage well. And we want to try it with one pilot program. So the idea would be, if it's successful here at this transit center, I mean, theoretically, you could do it, and that was the idea initially, was do it along the light rail stations. You could do it at the park and rides. So there's opportunity, but we kind of wanted to take one place where there's a whole high density that's close, kind of where we can service it. And so that's why we picked the bus transit. So.
Yeah, no, I agree with the location. It's whenever you pick one location in any type of study, you wonder how robust it is. And, can you move this around and try in different locations?
Well,
can we get multiple ones?
We could. I think what we have to decide on, as Heather's making the point, we have to kind of look at the technology that we're going to use, mm-hmm. and that cost and kind of how that works. And so I don't think we're opposed to experimenting maybe with different technologies at different locations and kind of seeing how that works. But we just really thought the idea would work out really well You know, if they're on the bus or the light rail and they have need of some reading material, we could provide that service and use that as an opportunity.
Because not only in those two locations, which are transit-oriented, but I'm thinking maybe our the clubhouses of the retirement communities, the active adult might be a decent place for.
Well, yeah, we could.
As an example.
Yeah,
We've also talked about, just internally with staff, about Gateway. You know, it'd be a great place to hit people using the airport. So.
Because you see that at some airports where you can check out a book, and then when you return, you put it back. So there's a lot of opportunities here. So we're going to start off and see where it goes.
We're going to start off there and then move it around. This is a great program. You've been talking about this for some time, so
yeah.
I was very excited to see this when I was reviewing this a couple of days ago, to see this program. This is extremely innovative, and it really speaks to the sea change in how people access library services in the future. And along that line, too, is there any update you can provide on what's happening with the Greater Phoenix Digital Library? Everybody's getting their iPad, e-readers, and so I know that Mesa cardholders have access to that. So what's going on there?
Vice Mayor Summers, you're right. We're one of 10 libraries in a consortium to provide the Greater Phoenix Digital Library to our cardholders. And currently, the libraries spend about $500,000 every year purchasing those digital books. Obviously, that's almost our entire materials budget. So the fact that we're part of this consortium means that our library card holders have access to something that we could not afford to provide on our own. So it's a huge bonus. The e-reader world is still changing, still developing, and publishers are sort of struggling with the library lending model. So there are certain publishers who will not sell to libraries, so we cannot even offer their titles as an e-reader. For example, right now the Help has an enormously large e-reader hold list. It's because at one point it was offered as a title that we could buy. They stopped offering it. We cannot buy any more copies, and so the copies that we have are the only copies that we can provide. the other things that publishers are doing, HarperCollins has a model right now where it used to be you buy the book model is you buy the copy and you have it until it wears out. Well, with ebooks, they don't wear out. So HarperCollins has a model where they will sell to libraries, but after 26 circs, I think it is, after 26 circulations, they pull it. We no longer have access to it. We have to buy a new copy. So they're, like I said, they're really kind of struggling with how libraries lend e-readers. But the American Library Association and a number of people are really trying to get it through to the book publishers that libraries have always been a huge partner in selling books. People who come to libraries use books in libraries, but they also buy books. And we introduce them to authors that they wouldn't buy on their own until after they've had a chance to read it for free. So that's one of the things that we're working with right now. Here at Mesa, we received a grant this year, and we now have Nooks available for checkout. So and that's been very popular. That just started just last month. And so it gives people a chance to check it out and see what the technology can do for them and if it is something they would like to do. I was at a lunch recently, and a city staff member was telling me that she checked it out. She likes the book. She doesn't really want to do the Nook, but she had an opportunity to try it, and she thought it was a lot of fun. So, you know, it's a great way of introducing people to the technology. Again, and people who don't necessarily have the money to afford that technology gives them a chance to use it.
Yeah. Seems reminiscent to the music industry and their changing from selling CDs to,
yes,
in some ways, selling CDs to digital and how they were going to handle that. So I think over the next 5 years, you're going to see everybody start to fall in line. Councilmember Kavanaugh, sir.
Thank you. In the coming fiscal year, do you see any positives or opportunities in our long-running discussion with the Maricopa County Library District and our situation of being the, you know, the large donor to the district, a very small recipient. I know in our discussions earlier this fiscal year, I think you were hopeful that new administration there might offer some opportunity. I'm just curious to know where that is or where you see it going this coming year.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, at this point, we haven't heard anything new about the reciprocal borrowing program. Last year, the Maricopa County Library District did something different. In addition to the reciprocal borrowing program, they did what they call the Materials Assistance Program. And they took $1 million and they divvied it up. Rather, instead of based on reciprocal borrowing numbers, they divvied it up based on how much tax each municipal polity put into the library district. So as a result, Mesa received about $100,000 that we were allowed to spend with their vendor. So we purchased $100,000 worth of materials that we would not have been able to purchase out of our own funds. Several of us have suggested, and we're going to keep suggesting, that the reciprocal borrowing program be revamped to follow that model, which would be a, in my mind, I don't know about the library district, but in my mind, it would be a fairer way of distributing those reciprocal borrowing dollars. Because I just happened to have a conversation, the town of Gilbert asked a consultant to look at their library because they have a different agreement with the library district to run Southeast Regional and the Perry Libraries. And she basically told them that they were getting a, to quote her, screaming deal. And really they're getting a screaming deal for the Gilbert Libraries because Mesa residents and many other Maricopa County residents are subsidizing it. Yes.
Maybe it's an opportunity both through our InterGov program and our you know, through us as council colleagues, because there are supervisor elections this year. It certainly could be appropriate to, particularly here in the East Valley, raise it to candidates regarding the inequity that faces our residents in doing it. So I hope it's an ongoing topic. Maybe Councilmember Glover's committee could address that issue or look at that in the coming months. Thank you.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
All right, and our last slide is the financial review. Really, I just wanted to point out that there is a, it's just so nice there's no reduction. And there's even a small little bump up because of these innovations, but really the many innovations are very minimal cost overall to the library's budget.
Yeah, and just we have to go back and say Heather has done a tremendous job. Here we are today talking about increasing library hours with no requests for additional funding to do it. And it's purely be done because of great management of figuring out their resources and how to use their personnel to get them out on the front counter. And that's why we really pushed departments this year to look at innovations with impact, so you can take innovations like the sorters, the bin sorters, and find ways to get our employees behind, you know, get them out of those kind of duties and get them out in front with the customers. And this is a great example of how that's worked. So I think there's a lot of great innovations in here, but I think that first one with expanding library hours without having to have any additional cost from the city is good news.
Alex?
I just wanted to add on to that. I was anticipating, you know, I think back prior to getting on council, and I remember opening the paper over a period of years, and every time I saw something negative, it seemed to be involved with the library being cut back and the negative impacts, and it was just really, you know, an unpleasant experience to watch. So now, having gone through the Great Recession and everything, just like the city manager, just watching the cultural change that's through the library, the innovation, I just can't say wow enough. That's the one that stands out to me, along with several other city departments that have just made tremendous strides in rethinking how they do things. And I know it's because of your good leadership and the wonderful staff that you have, and it'll be great. I don't think maybe most residents won't realize or make the association I do that next time they read about the library, it'll be about innovation and expanding services, where years ago it was just a drag, I got to tell you, when I read about all the things that were going on. So wonderful. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you, Councilmember Fincher. It really is staff. They care so much, and they've worked so hard. So thank you. I'll make sure they hear that news.
No, I think Councilmember Fincher is spot on with those comments, and I echo them. When you look at all the city departments, I think the library is the one arguably impacted the hardest by the budget change, but also at the same time, you are dealing with a change in technology and how people access that information, how this new generation of library users accesses that information and what their expectations are. So you're dealing with the fiscal strain at the same time you're dealing with a change in a library model, and you've been able to manage both so expertly and provide an expanding level of service and meeting those expectations has just been phenomenal. So I continue to look forward to how these things change and evolve over time. It's just been a pleasure to watch your work, and I think the library patrons and the citizens of Mesa really do appreciate it. At least I hope they do. So well done. Anything else? No? I'm not recognizing you. No. Dave.
Do I look different today or something?
And that's it for Dave.
He's getting senile already. Jeez. There's a few slides past the financial slide that, you know, I know that they're at the discretion, but I wanted to point out the success of the Mesa Express Library and how it's completely blown projections out of the water and what a great innovation that is. So I just, you know, everybody's piling on such, you know, the good news, and so I think I want to jump on too. That's a really cool innovation, and it'll be interesting to see how we're able to apply that in other parts of the city that don't have libraries to serve them too. So great, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in addition to this, I think how the what did you call that little electronic feeder? The
sorter,
the thing we're going to put at the bus stop.
Oh yeah,
automated vending. Well, automated materials vending machine.
Automated materials vending is another way to do that outreach. It's going to be very interesting to see how we measure that and how successful that is. That is a unique, innovative idea for sure. Anything else? Accolades? No? Anybody want to yell at them? Because we've been kind of pouring it on thick.
No?
We'll save it for ITD. Get off the hook. We're going to hold it. Hey, ITD, it's coming.
Okay. Thank you.
Where are the victims? Good morning.
I'm going to start off.
With iPads, I know I saw the presentation.
Brown nosing, and that we are actually very grateful, and I brag about you all the time, in having such a supportive council, city manager, mayor, who really get technology, use it, adapt it, and know its value. So that's been tremendously helpful for us as we
just move made
forward
it
with our program. I really quickly just wanted to look at even just last year and the amazing things that technology is doing. Departments are doing a fabulous job, everything from the police officer on the street to courtroom, of course, and what the judges are able to do now, to our field workers out in the field. Amazing changes going on.
If I could interrupt, how you got firefighters to be able to use computer tablets? And see, that is really impressive, wouldn't you say, Alex? They can't do that in Phoenix.
I mean, all it took for them to actually experience it. I mean, when they saw the value of what they could do out in the field and not the paper chase that they've been doing, it's been amazing. And when you say field workers, fire workers, you also have inspectors in the field in water and gas. That's a real challenge, too, to have them out in the field with
laptops.
Lots
of pictures and lots of positive feedback. That's really what you need.
Exactly. One of the nice things really been fabulous is we stood here a couple of years ago and said we're going to grow with our use of maintenance management systems. We're at 500 employees now using those systems across multiple departments, and that's been amazing. I asked my document management guy, and I was even surprised. I mean, the last 3 months, 400,000 pages from paper to digital in just the last 3 months, they're joining 97 million pages in our document management system. But my favorite part is in the document management system, you have retention schedules. So we're actually to the point now where we're automatically starting to delete content like we should be in a more automated method, and that's what's happening with our document management system as well. Through this all, the stuff that's not so visible and not so glorious and probably not so fun for you to know about is all the infrastructure work that we do. We work very hard to keep it secure, stable, available, and we've made significant changes to our platforms in network, server, and storage over the past year. We average 19, 20 major portfolio projects a year, and then we do 300 to 400 minors of a whole variety of different sizes. These are just some of the examples. We actually have Wi-Fi in 31 locations in the city now. Those numbers are growing, and not surprising because of the growth of mobile services. I think you're seeing some of the things when you see the 3D modeling that we did with GIS across the city, how you can visually show some of the data. Sometimes it's simple things like turning PCs off at night so we can save power, and then just as important, turning them back on in the morning right before the employee arrives for work, or to the automated notifications we do for late bills. You're going to hear, as you have been hearing with Heather, with Cindy, and so many, all the different ways departments are embracing technology, and we are so excited to see that happen. Some of it is brand new services, rethinking things. Some of it is simply upgrading existing applications and moving on with replacements of systems. So the three things I wanted to kind of talk about from an IT perspective that's been on our industry talk is mobile, cloud, and legacy, because our job really is a mix of old and new. There's all this wonderful new stuff we're talking about, and then there's those legacy systems that run the 40-plus businesses in the city that really keep this city operating. So it's everything from a building permitting system to the email that's stacking up in your box to the iMesa app on your iPad. And so it's really, I like to call it an exciting tug-of-war, because we need to do quality, planned investments of your high-dollar projects. And then we need to be able to be really flexible, accept some risk, and figure out how to change everything we know about it as we move into some of these mobile services. So it really is a tug-of-war between the old and the new in IT. When I try to explain what my department does without sliding into geekdom and lots of diagrams and charts, this was my best visual to say we really have a bunch of platforms that builds up. But we work very hard to keep every single one of these platforms stable, available, plugged in and operating for you. At the same time, we're trying to change every single thing about them. I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and
I'm sorry. Yes. I have to. So you don't think we're smart enough to be geeks? Is that what you're saying?
I just had to throw that out there. You to my geekdom. Actually, we're all,
we're all geeks,
right?
Look where we're
right.
At. Yes, exactly. Okay. All right, good.
But we sat in a room, and a few people said, actually the speaker, the thing said, an IT decade right now is 3 years in terms of rate of change. And across the room, everybody totally agreed. When you look back at what you've done every 3 years of late, it totally has shrunk down. And that's the amount of rate of change that we're dealing with. So this guy is one of the big ones, mobile services. They say by 2016, there'll be over 10 billion internet devices in the world. So if population matches that, you hit basically about one device for every person on the planet. Now, we all know, and I would imagine all around the room, we're already carrying more than one device. We're carrying two and three devices. So that's really the challenge that we have in front of us. And what we need to do is, literally what we said, is how do we balance the security and the things that we need to do and not restrict the mobile worker? We need to know if sensitive data is being downloaded to a tablet. We need to know if someone's trying to use their iPhone to get to the city's water system. So this upcoming year is going to be a lot of work and emphasis on education, because some of it's simple best practices with your mobile devices, and some of it's tools behind the scenes so that we can find out and kind of protect what's going on. We also are pushing very hard for our vendors to move towards the web. There's so much you can't do until you get that application into web-based mode for mobile users. We'll work on things we can do in the interim, but it's a heavy push. These are very complex, highly integrated systems that just suddenly can't, head to the web and become available from your iPhone. We are also pushing a lot in that, as I'll talk in the future, about how we plan that upgrade. We actually store currently 20 terabytes of data in the city, and it's both application data, your Word documents, your Excel spreadsheets, and it's so much more that we could be doing to take that data and make it meaningful to the citizen, as well as be able to manage it internally. Reporting is a classic example of something with this data analysis and being able to do business analytics with the data typically was an IT function. But the tools today and where the systems are headed are very much making it now a business function, a department function. So what we need to do is get that training into the departments to be able to use the tools, to do the business analysis. And in IT, I need the data architects to be able to shape the data and do the data design so we can even offer it up to the departments to be able to use. I literally have on my roadmap for my department is I'll have an organized formal business intelligence part of my org chart at some time here in the future so that we can really focus in on that type of work. Many of you, thanks to great marketing, know what the cloud is, and it's not new. We've had it for years, and we've been embracing the value of it. Right out of the gate, we initially went for those niche services that were pretty self-contained, things like electronic patient care, to do a recruitment of an employee, and we're actually looking to doing our parks registration from a service in the cloud. The highly integrated systems, though, that we have, these legacy systems, those are a different story, and those are the things we'll have to look at and to where we can leverage the cloud to the city's best interest. And we actually are doing that every time we go out to look for an upgrade, for a replacement, or look ahead at these applications in the future. We've also internally been building our own cloud, if you will. It's been several years now that we've embraced virtualization, which is one of the tools that makes the cloud useful. We have done server virtualization. We did our storage virtualization most recently and desktop virtualization. So we're creating a lot of opportunities internally to save costs and improve the turnaround time as we start new services as well. However, I would not be doing my job if I didn't touch briefly on the growing complexity that is IT. What looks so cool, slick, and easy for you on the device that you're using is creating incredible complexity behind the scenes for IT and responsibility. And we take it very seriously. I've nicknamed it internally Operation Excellence. We've been in front of you for a couple of council reports in the past because what it often means is to buy and fund redundancy so that we have to keep this always on, always available platform. It takes having multiple things at different locations so that you're not dealing with power failure issues, multiple boxes so that if one fails, the other one recovers, all of those types of tools. So it does take discipline in our processes. We've been taking a relook across the board of did we take shortcuts anywhere? Did we make decisions in our architecture due to budget that we now need to go back and address and fix in order for us to be as always on as that you're seeking these tools to be? And we'll continue that push. And for us this year, it will be in the terms of tools for enterprise monitoring. We absolutely have to know before you do that something's failing. And finally, one of the things we would like to do for innovation is I'm just calling it seeds of innovation. It's really important that we have opportunities just to explore. You know, so much we're caught up in projects where everything's funded, defined, and we're implementing. I need opportunities for people to pitch a business idea and work on a proof of concept. And a proof of concept often means maybe training. It might need some seed money. It mainly needs the time. We need to be able to provide the priority time for you to not do all this other stuff, but focus in on this one proof of concept. So I'm going to be working on an idea market in IT where we actually have people be able to pitch, compete, and then we award. And most importantly, they get the opportunity to work on some of these innovations. Key to my competitive IT market is salary is always key, but in addition to salary is the ability to do new things and to work on the cutting edge technology. This kind of program will give my people some ability to do some of that and help with that staff retention. Finally, we must always continue to plan. We have a forecasted 8-year plan in terms of infrastructure, and we've been very appreciative of the city support and council support in maintaining funding for infrastructure. We have now had that planned out in terms of business applications, much like a CIP program, and we have this lovely paper tool that I use to model this method. But much like a CIP program, applications age. Technology changes and renders things obsolete. And we have to plan for that cycle in terms of upgrades, in terms of replacements. Some of these applications are way more expensive than others, so we need opportunity to forecast and save and do the cash flow of when some of these big significant replacements occur. So that is what I call my application life cycle management. It's something that will be in front of council, updating you on a regular basis as we proceed through. And with that, I have the operational budget of ITD, which is stayed largely fairly flat because we have been working very hard at reducing our maintenance contracts with vendors and some of those kinds of decisions. Plus, our budget ebbs and flows based on whether it's heavy infrastructure projects that are going on that fiscal year because those are in our budget. Heavy business projects, the funding is in the business, is in the department's budget. We're just managing the effort.
Councilmember Richards.
How does this reflect the money being spent on City Edge and the staffing needs for City Edge, or are those embedded in
the City Edge funding is in another department budget, yes. So this doesn't reflect the goods and services and the capital dollars of City Edge.
Okay, and with all these different technological changes, what kind of different expertise are you going to need to bring into the city? Are you planning any new FTEs at all, is there just some turnover and...
We're absolutely trying to retool. We have been some of our newer hirings. We might have, for example, have typically gone out for a database person. This time, we actually, when we had a vacancy, we went out looking for business intelligence for business objects type of expertise. So as we have a vacancy occur from a retirement, that type of situation, we take a look and go, what's our most important need, and we reshape that vacancy and go after that skill. So it's that, and it's also retooling existing staff.
Are there going to be any staff members affected by the change to City Edge that are experts in the current system? And when that current system goes away, how is that transition occurring?
Absolutely. I mean, parts of City Edge is replacing mainframe. Good and bad, we have really limited mainframe skills left, which is why the big push to absolutely get City Edge done and get also the court system done. So we didn't hang on to a big suite of mainframe people, but those mainframe people are knee-deep in the project, learning those new skills and retooling.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and just Vice Mayor Councilman Richens, I mean, Diane, we're actually part of the City Edge completion or going into that project is we are going to be doing assessments, evaluations of staff to help identify the skill sets they have that they're going to, help identify where they are and figure out the gap of the skill sets they're going to need in order to be able to interface with City Edge. And you have already set up, we've discussed this kind of that process and doing that evaluation, helping our employees understand there may be some new skill sets, I don't know, aptitudes that they're going to have to be able to perform with City Edge. And so there is a process that Diane's outlined where there's a group of city employees that are going to help those employees kind of work through that process.
I think I want to continue to understand this, the budgetary interplay between this technological innovation in the departments and the IT department and where those costs are being allocated, sure, and embedded. So from a, you know, because if you look at it from just a pure IT update, You see these costs, but I know that in a department there's some implementation costs as well there. I support innovation through technology. I just don't know that I completely understand the full costs of it and how, sure, how they're being.
No, that's
out.
A fair question. Mm-hmm. Right now, the cost for the development and implementation of City Edge is really trying to be kept separate so we can track that cost and whether it includes, as we pull staff out of departments to put them on the project because we need their specific expertise in that area. We are helping them with backfilling with temporary employees, but all those costs are trying to charge to the City Edge project. And we've done this before, and we'd be glad to come back to council and kind of give you an update on where that is. Once we kind of get through the implementation, then we can kind of talk about that'll, and we'll kind of settle out, get past the project, mm-hmm, itself, which is kind of one budget process, and then as we go forward, we can help identify within the departments and whether it's ITD, the ongoing support that we'll need to continue in that area.
Great, thanks.
And actually, City Edge, the new system, gives us a better way to consolidate that so you can see those different projects and their costs.
Any other questions? Comments? Concerns? Profanities? Nothing. Dave? Oh. Oh,
Dave misses the additional slides. Thank you very much. See, that wasn't that painful, was it? We'll talk about you in the hall, don't worry. All right, with that, meetings or conferences attended. Anyone? Dave? Duathlon?
Oh.
Meetings and conferences attended.
Last Saturday, the Parks and Rec Department put on a duathlon, I think is the correct term, where it's a swim and run race. Councilmember Summers did the kickoff, and I did the race. So it was a lot of fun. I saw several other staff members there, and they all kicked my butt, but it was fun to participate. It was a really well-put-together event for a first-year event. I had a lot of fun, and I was sore for at least a couple of days after it.
You just have to do it more often now. Where'd you go out for big pizza and milkshakes right after? Or? No? All right. Well, see, it's progress. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Just remind the council, we have another study session next Thursday, the 19th, continuing budget reviews, and we'll have a few executive session items that we need to cover at that time. And also remind you that this Saturday is the first anniversary of the Alston House and the 35th anniversary of the Washington Activity Center celebration. So it's Saturday, April 14th from 4 to 8 at the Washington Activity Center. So I invite everybody to that. And then we also have this Saturday the first Great Arizona Bicycle Festival. So it'll be this Saturday, April 14th on Main Street from Center to Robeson. A celebration. Everything that's related to bike. There's going to be a Tour de Mesa. There's going to be a bike swap, a kids fun zone, live music. So it's going to be a lot of fun. So again, here in downtown Mesa from 8 to 3 this Saturday.
Nothing ever happens in this town. Yeah, we have a lot of exciting things going on. Ms. Crocker, items from citizens present?
No speaker.
None. All right, I have a motion from Councilmember Glover, a second from Councilwoman Higgins to adjourn. All in favor, get up and walk away. We are adjourned.